Gene Dodaro is the Comptroller General of the United States. It's a pleasure to talk to you again, as always, Gene. Let's start with the groundwork here. What is the difference between fragmentation, overlap, and duplication?
Well, fragmentation is when we have more than one federal agency involved in the same broad area of national need, and opportunities exist to improve service delivery. That's very important. There has to be, you know, both multiple areas involved, but also the opportunities for more efficiencies. Overlap occurs when we have multiple agencies for programs having similar goals, engaged in similar activities or strategies to achieve them, or target similar beneficiaries. And duplication occurs when two or more agencies or programs are engaged in the same activities or provide the same services to the same beneficiaries. We focus on fragmentation and overlap as well as duplication because we find fragmentation and overlap often can be harbingers of duplication.
Mm-hmm. So you find, you find 11 new areas of fragmentation, overlap, and duplication, 15 areas to reduce costs. Now, you and I have spoken about these reports in the past. That's down considerably from the first three reports that you did. Are you running out of places to look, or are agencies getting better at finding these issues themselves and fixing them, or some other reason or some combination there?
Well, in the first 3 years of tackling this mandate that the Congress gave us, the goal that we set up for ourselves was to try to cover all major parts of the federal government. So that was a full press, full court press, if you will, on those areas. And I found that, we were able to do that mostly, but there's still some areas. So I'm not surprised that the number's now coming down. And so it is some combination of people, you know, looking themselves for these opportunities. But importantly, the fact that, we have looked in most major places of the government already, and we're looking still for other areas, as it will be an annual requirement.
Do you have a sense that because it's an annual requirement and the agencies now know you're paying attention and Congress therefore is paying attention, that they are being more comprehensive about trying to find places where something may already be being done?
Well, I hope that's the case, Francis, but I really don't know for sure.
The beginning of this report states that you have 162 areas for attention, 380 actions that agencies or Congress or both could take to address the issues that you've raised, but you also write about some success stories. What do you think is bringing about those success stories, and what is your sense of how those agencies are doing, farm payment programs, passenger aviation security fees, and so on? What's bringing those success stories about, and do you have a sense of what some of the themes may be?
Yes, I think clearly the federal budgetary pressures and the advent of sequestration actually taking effect in 2013 period of time really has focused attention on finding alternatives to sequestration that will bring down federal spending and will not have unintended consequences on programs, activities, and therefore on the public. And so clearly I believe that the fiscal pressures are a principal driver toward focusing attention on these issues. And I think the Congress and the administration are both looking for ways to make government more efficient and effective, given our long-term fiscal challenges as well. So I think the combination of those factors, but clearly I believe that the fiscal pressures are the primary driver.
I'm struck by the number of times that executives in the federal government use the word opportunity to talk about where the budget situation is taking them, to push them in directions that they otherwise might not have gone, and it sounds like that's the same situation that you're seeing too.
Yes, I believe that that's the case, and it's a healthy development. I mean, I think these type of activities and pressures are necessary to bring about efficiencies. I would hope that the efficiencies are found absent pressure. But the pressure does intensify people's focus on trying to be creative and innovative, and ideas that may not have been thought possible in the past are now coming into the forefront. The passenger aviation security fees is a prime example. We've had that recommendation on the books for a while now, but I think given looking for alternatives to sequestration, it became more appealing.
Mm-hmm. One section of this report is titled, Sustained Leadership Attention is Critical of Advancing and Maintaining Progress on Suggested Actions. That is a pretty widely accepted leadership principle that you need buy-in from the top. Why did you think it was necessary to emphasize that the way that you did in this report?
Well, Francis, I think the primary reason was that we saw more progress on areas where individual agencies had responsibility for an area and a little less progress in areas where there were multiple programs that covered multiple agencies and multiple committees of jurisdiction on the Hill. And that for that those areas where you have they're more cross-cutting in nature, you need a different level of sustained attention and leadership commitment to focus on that. So I thought it was very necessary to say that because those areas will be the most difficult ones to fix, where you have to have multiple parties involved both in the executive branch and in the Congress to reach appropriate resolution. And it's very important to do that, and it won't happen without special attention, which is the other reason why I thought it was necessary to highlight that.
And that strikes at the collaborative effort that the administration is emphasizing among agencies. Are you seeing an increase in attention on those cross-agency issues, and are you seeing the kind of collaboration that's necessary to close those gaps in future years?
Yeah, I think clearly the requirement in the GPRA Modernization Act for the administration to identify cross-cutting priority goals has increased the attention on those issues. And actually, many of the new high-risk areas we've added since 2009 are cross-cutting issues across multiple agencies as well. So there is increased attention, but there's still opportunities for more attention. We think GPRA can be used to focus more on collaborative efforts, and we haven't seen that as much as we'd like to see going across the government yet.
Most of the provisions, you write about the provisions of the GPRA Modernization Act, but a lot of my takeaway from what is in the report is that it's still mostly about potential, what could happen if the act is maximized to its full effect. Do you see agencies on the right track to that full potential, full implementation of the provisions of the Act, or is there still some activity that they could take, do you think, to get them that direction?
I think we've seen some signs of progress and continued attention to implementing the Act, but the Act, in my opinion, is still a ways from achieving its full potential, and there are definitely areas that we've pointed out that the executive branch could take to further the goals in the GPRA Modernization Act. For example, as we were just discussing, we believe they're missing opportunities to address cross-cutting issues. Mm-hmm. This is particularly important in these quarterly progress reviews that we've looked at. Sometimes not all the potential parties are involved, and importantly, tax expenditures are not routinely looked at in the context of the total look across government in conjunction with programs. Secondly, there's a need to use the performance information more in managing programs. Our surveys since 1997 have found little improvement in managers' reported use of performance information or practices. We're hopeful that these quarterly performance reviews under GPRA will change the situation, and we'll be eagerly looking at signs that that is the case in our future evaluations. Also, it's very important. Agencies are still having difficulty tackling some longstanding issues with measuring performance across programs and activities, and we're hopeful the Performance Improvement Council will focus on these activities. We also think that performance.gov, the public website, can be improved, that we found a lot of people feeling that they could make improvements in accessibility, availability, understandability, and relevance of the performance information to the public. And we suggested further outreach to stakeholders in order to help the administration improve that website. And lastly, you know, I think there's many more opportunities for consultations with the Congress. We've have pointed that out and are hopeful that that will be the case, because I think that that will continue to have an important dialogue between the executive and legislative branch on, you know, what are our goals, how to measure performance, and then hopefully provide a good framework for how to allocate resources within those priorities of what government is trying to achieve, which I think will bring about efficiencies and also more better common understanding of the programs and their priorities.
Let's go to the issue of performance information and measures. You've mentioned that there's still some room for improvement there among the agencies. What is your sense of what is holding them back at this point? I talk about big data on my program all the time. These agencies have floods of information now that they've never had before. Is it harnessing that information and sorting it all out? Is it understanding what the information means and how they can apply it to what they're doing? Something else, some combination of those? What is your sense of that?
Yeah, well, there's a variety of factors at play here. I think that in a number of cases, particularly when you have these new cross-cutting goals and objectives now, how to get common agreement on common outcomes across a range of activities is very important. There needs to be continued focus on collecting accurate and reliable data. We still see that the data that is collected, and you're correct that there is a lot of information collected, but how much of it's reliable and accurate, and that's a major issue that needs attention as well. And then thirdly, some of these areas are just very difficult to measure, particularly where you have programs that involve intermediaries to deliver the service, particularly at the state and local level, or there's a combination of state and federal money involved in some of these programs. So some of them are difficult to do, but I think there has to be more attention focused on, you know, what are the goals you want to achieve, and a lot of the measures that are collected now are more output measures of activities and not really outcome measures. And this, there needs to be more evaluations of whether the programs are achieving their objectives. We've highlighted this in a number of our reports. For example, there are 47 employment training programs, but only a handful had an official evaluation in many years. Mm-hmm. About two-thirds of the 209 science, technology, and engineering and math programs that we had identified had not had an evaluation. Some of the programs are too small to have an evaluation, and so there is a need to look at consolidation. So there's a wide variety of factors. This is a difficult issue to tackle, but we must do it if we want to have better information to make resource allocation decisions in an era of increased, you know, deficits and debt.
A quick distinction that I think is useful. You use the words output versus outcome. They're two different meanings. Just clarify that so we understand the difference between those two terms, because I think sometimes people could mix them up.
Right. No, it's an important distinction. You know, an output is a level of activity. For example, in a training program, how many people are trained? And outcome is, well, of those people who've been trained, how many have actually got jobs and have been able to keep their employment? And so therefore, was the program not helpful only in just getting people trained, but achieving its ultimate objective, which is to have those people receive gainful employment and be able to retain that employment over time. Mm-hmm. So it's a very important distinction that needs to be made, and we need to be focused on ultimate outcomes, because that's really the intention and the objectives of most programs, but it's difficult to measure. Mm-hmm. And so the government needs to of all the money it's spending, invest more in finding out the outcomes, because only then can you tell whether the programs are achieving their objectives efficiently and effectively.
And it seems to me if an agency's not doing that now, there's a pretty good way to determine return on investment that you can demonstrate that that's worthwhile for you to pursue that even in tight budget times.
Yeah, clearly, Francis, clearly.
Let's go to the Congress piece of this, because I spoke to a person in an agency not too long ago and said, hey, we do what they tell us to do. We don't go and create programs on our own. And the onus is on Congress to interact with agencies, it seems to me, to determine, as you suggested, had to have an ongoing dialogue with agencies and to understand before they create a program what they're already doing. One of the holdups to that has been definitions of programs and what agencies are already doing, a definitive inventory. And you and I have spoken about that before. But you write again this year about the difficulty that agencies have in coming to a uniform definition of what a program is. Why is that a tough nut for agencies to crack? It would seem that if you're doing something and the idea is to reach an outcome, that's a program. Why is it not quite that simple?
Well, there's a complicated history and cultural issue here that has to be overcome. I mean, a lot of agencies haven't been forced to confront this issue before, and OMB gave them flexibility. They could use the budget account structure. They could use a program definition. They were given wide flexibility, so it really did not fully address the issue about then how you can compare programs across the government to see if there is overlap and duplication or need for greater coordination. And so I think this is a significant limitation that we've seen, which was ultimately the GPRA requirement was to create a standardized program inventory across the federal government. It's not easy to do. I'm not minimizing the difficulty, but you'll never get there if you give everybody their own options for how to define a program. And this is very important that it be tackled. Also, so far, all the government agencies haven't been asked to do this. It only started with the larger departments and agencies, so it's not fully implemented yet. But it's very important to do this, and it's also important in the dialogue with the Congress to understand everybody's talking about the same thing. Mm-hmm. At some point, and right now it's difficult to do that without a complete inventory. It's hard to explain, I think, to the American public why the federal government cannot have a complete standardized inventory of all its program spendings and the programs that it's undertaking and have that transparently available. I'm also pleased that the Data Act has passed now both houses of Congress and it's on its way to the president for signature because that will require standardized data definitions and how spending is made and require more transparency over federal spending. So I think the combination, if we can get the inventory right and if we can get more accurate standardized data available on federal spending, those are two tools that will help the Congress. It'll help the administration and it'll help understand and enhance public understanding of what actually government does with the money that it collects and borrows.
You don't have that inventory today. So not having that inventory and not having those set definitions fully implemented across government, how does that make your job here at GAO harder?
Well, we have to dig deeper and wider to try to identify that information. It makes data collection much more difficult to do and requires more resources on our part and actually on the part of the agencies because they have to provide us the information we're looking for. And often it's not readily available. So it makes it much more difficult also to come up with specific solutions about how you can address some of the overlap and duplication that we've identified. So both in terms of doing the work, but also limiting our ability to provide specific solutions and options for addressing these issues. In both ways, it affects us.
Is it your sense that that inventory trajectory is headed in the right direction, that the agencies are gaining ground, not losing ground?
Well, we're looking at that now, Francis. I don't have a good sense on where we are in the spectrum. Mm-hmm. I know we're not where we need to be.
Uh-huh.
How far along we'll be able to tell once our work is completed.
I'd like to ask you about a couple of the new areas of fragmentation, overlap, duplication, and areas to reduce costs, enhance revenue collection. There are six of them in particular that strike at the business, day-to-day business of federal agencies I was curious about. One of the cross-cutting ones in particular is the interoperable radio communication system. That's the ability for agencies, first responders, to speak to each other quickly, not just on the federal level, but all across the spectrum. What's the status of that? Why is this important? And what did you find when you looked there?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's important for the reasons that you state, is that our first responders and law enforcement personnel need to have an effective ability to communicate, to carry out their responsibilities in a timely manner, and time matters in their line of business. And we looked at this. There was a program called the Integrated Wireless Network that was intended to be a collaborative effort among the Departments of Justice, Homeland Security, and the Treasury Department to provide a secure, seamless, interoperable, and reliable nationwide wireless communication to support law enforcement, protective services, homeland defense, and disaster response missions. But that effort was abandoned in 2008. And we believe, and each agency now is going their own way in developing their system. And we believe that had they followed proper collaborative processes, they would have been able to achieve this objective. Now, and we've recommended that the Congress require them to get back together and to operate more efficiently to achieve this objective. We're not suggesting, and this is important, that there be one system, but there needs to be a blueprint so that the systems they are developing on their own are interoperable.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a critical function.
So the gist of it is you want to make sure that those systems talk to each other but not dictate that the agencies all have to have the same equipment. They can get equipment that accommodates their individual needs.
That's exactly right.
Next one is combatant command headquarters costs. Now, Secretary Gates, Secretary Panetta, Secretary Hagel have all spoken extensively about cutting overhead in at the OSD level. This one addresses the combatant commands and the costs there. What did you find in that area?
Yeah, well, what we found is the cost of the combatant commands has grown exponentially, both in dollar costs and the number of personnel. Part of it was due to the stand-up of the Northern Command for Homeland Security and the stand-up of the Africa Command. And that there's not systematic processes in place to regularly reevaluate the size of these, the need for all the functions. They're collecting data. It's not consistent across the commands. It's not transparent in the budget process. So we've made recommendations that DOD move in that direction to help them continue to provide the right type of rigor that you should apply to making sure that you are only having the people you need to in the functions and have regular reevaluations of that, and to provide the Congress with more information to help them make good oversight decisions and scrutinize the effort. We also found and suggested that they reevaluate their decision to keep the Africa Command headquarters in Germany rather than an alternative location. We didn't think the analysis that was done to support that decision was as comprehensive as need be. And we believe addressing these issues will help them become more efficient and effective and hopefully bring down the cost.
Do the efforts that Secretary Hagel and other leadership at OSD are making now fit with the recommendations that you're making? It strikes me that they started to undertake them before this report came out, but it seems like they're syncing with what you're recommending.
Yes, they're a step in the right direction and consistent with our recommendations. We just believe they don't go far enough. And they also don't routinize these type of reviews. They were one-time efforts, which are laudable, but you need to have a regular process in place to look on a systematic basis at these programs and activities going forward, given the breadth of our military activities.
The next one is federal real property ownership and leasing. And my sense of this is that this is a pendulum issue. You've been following these issues a little longer than I have, but depending on who's in charge in Congress, there is a movement for a period of time that we should be leasing and not buying, and then we should be buying and not leasing, and this pendulum swings. Is this quantifiable sufficiently that you can make, not you specifically, but that GSA or the agencies can make one decision and keep it that way about whether it makes sense, even in individual situations, for an agency to buy or lease their property and what their footprint should look like?
Well, we need better information to be able to do this. We took a look at what are called high value leases, which in 2012 when we did our evaluation, that was the latest data available, is $2.79 million in annual cost. And while the lease, those high value leases are only about 3% of the total number of leases, they account for 30% of the amount of money that's spent. And in some cases, we've been leasing the same property for 40 years. So clearly there needs to be a better evaluation of alternatives. It makes sense to lease in some cases, but in other cases it makes sense to buy and own the property. And we suggested that GSA include more alternatives in lease prospectuses that it provides to the Congress so there's more visibility on this and then we can make informed decisions. There also needs to be attention to how you pay for these activities. That's been a source of the issue as well over time. But I think the data can be available to drive the decisions. Our recommendation goes to focusing more on making sure their alternatives are considered, are made transparent, and there's priority set on the part of GSA for conversions from leases to ownership over time. So we think that these types of discussions and analysis will help inform administration and congressional decisions ultimately on what's the least costly alternative for the federal government. And I'm hopeful that reforms can come about in this area.
The next is online taxpayer services, Gene. And the Internal Revenue Service has driven a lot of their taxpayer activity online. It has worked for them to help cut costs, and it has been important for their efforts to reduce personnel as their funding from Congress has gone down. What did you find when you looked at the services that the Internal Revenue Service is providing online?
Yeah, well, they have a lot of information online, forms and instructions and things, and those are very helpful. But there's still it drives a lot of demand for people to call for their telephone service activities. And we think if you had a more interactive website where, for example, people can have what's called dynamic account access, which is the ability to make account changes after confirming their identity online. Other taxing authorities have made this available, and either other parts of the federal government, for example, Social Security Administration allows users to start or change direct deposit benefit payments online. And the New York and California state tax agencies provide this dynamic access online, that this would really help IRS and help the American public and the taxpayers have easier processes. IRS has agreed, and they're looking at how to come up with a longer-term strategy to improve their website and services, so we're heartened by that. It's due to be available, I believe, in February 2015, so we're looking and we'll be evaluating what they're doing there. We also suggested they use more best practices in website designs, and so I'm hopeful that they can continue to modernize these online taxpayer services, and it'll be more helpful to both the IRS and the public. I think it's a win-win situation.
I'm not aware right now of any topic in contracting that gets people more divided, either hating it or loving it, than reverse auctions. Reverse auctions in government contracting, including commercial items, is one of the things that you look at here. Reverse auctions, again, seem to be one of these things that some people say are terrific in certain cases, and then there are other folks that think there's no good in them at all. What did you find when you looked at reverse auctions?
Well, we looked at back in December 2013, issued a report. I focused largely and found that the Army, Homeland Security, Interior, and Veterans Affairs would together account for about 70% of the reverse auctions in 2012. And what we found, the theory behind these is that reverse auction leverages competition. But what we found was in many cases there really wasn't a lot of competition, that there was only either one bidder or that there was only one bid when you had multiple bidders. So over a third of the fiscal year 2012 reverse auctions had no interactive bidding. And so it makes it difficult to judge, you know, how much the competition really affected this. We also found that they were paying fees to have people, provide the reverse auction services. There were $3.9 million in fees, and the agencies weren't always aware of the fees. And so how they're being factored into the decisions about how much money is ultimately saved through the process needs to be focused on as well. Importantly, we found that the federal acquisition regulations did not specifically address reverse auctions, and there's no government-wide guidance. So, mm-hmm. you know, we think that that's always an important foundation to have, and I think that may account for some of the split opinions mm-hmm. that you're hearing. And so we recommended that the administration put in place this guidance and amend the FAR, and my understanding is that considerations are underway to do that, and we'll be monitoring those activities. Hopefully that'll be helpful, and I'm not sure it'll resolve everybody's opinion about reverse auctions, but there needs to be more experience, I think, and data collected to see exactly what circumstances are appropriate and would be helpful to achieve the objectives of bringing down costs through this form of competition.
And the last one's the whopper, IT investment portfolio management. The government spends, the number fluctuates anywhere between 80 and 90 billion a year on IT, and some of the problems, struggles that the government's had with IT in the past year have made some pretty big headlines. This is something, IT investments of various kinds have been on the high-risk list probably since there's been a high-risk list. Are you seeing progress in this area? Are you seeing the agencies getting a better handle on how they're spending their money on IT? Or is this one trending in the wrong direction?
Well, some of the tools that have been put in place, the tech stat, and portfolio stat, and the IT dashboard, are all important tools, but need to be expanded, and you need to have more reliable information to be able to do it. So I've just testified recently on that point when testifying on the president's management agenda. In our overlap and duplication report and areas for cost savings, we identify portfolio stat, which now portfolio stat is designed to assist agencies in assessing their current maturity of their IT investment management processes, make decisions on eliminating duplicative investments, and moving to shared solutions, both within agencies and across federal agencies. So it's a very important initiative. But we found that, again, in some of these areas, there aren't appropriate accurate data on complete baselines that are available, and you need the complete baselines that are available on this. Also, some agencies aren't completing their migrations that they were supposed to in their commodity IT areas, the fundamentals of, email services, et cetera. And six agencies reported limitations on their chief information officers, purview over looking authority to review and approve this information. And the early reports from OMB weren't complete because they didn't include the Defense Department and the Justice Department. So they're now moving. So we need more complete information. The mm-hmm. tool itself has a lot of value, but will only be effective if there's complete, accurate information and that there's people that have the authority to really look at this. And this is going to be important not only within agencies but across agencies as well. So we made a number of recommendations to improve the guidance and activities in this area, and hopefully that'll bring about some additional changes. But we'll be continuing to evaluate this as this process unfolds.
One final question for you, Gene. Thank you very much for your time today. As I look over your shoulder in this terrific office, I see one of the most handsome young men inside a frame that I've ever seen. Who is that little guy back there?
That's my oldest grandson, Bryce. He's terrific. He's 5-year-old. Son, I now he has one little brother, is almost 1.5, and I've just recently also been fortunate enough to have two new granddaughters. So my family's expanding considerably, and I couldn't be happier.
congratulations on that. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much, Francis. Take care.